I've titled the sermon this morning, A Glimpse of How Things Really Are, and that's a line from a poem which will be read later in the service. But it's an audacious claim, how things really are. Who gets to say how things really are? And that's an important question, particularly in a world of spin rooms and fake news and alternative facts. And there's no shortage of people who are claiming that they are the ones who can really see, who want to wake up the rest of us to the way that things really are. But which voices are trustworthy? What is real? And what is just smoke and mirrors? Spin? Malarkey? Hokum? Hogwash? Baloney? Bull? We feel these questions not just in the public sphere, but also in ordinary life. In any given week, we are pushed and pulled by competing forces and feelings, joy, but also pain, connection, but also loneliness, hope, but also despair. The world's beauty and brokenness exert this equal pull on us. Good is so good that we think that all of the evil can be explained, and evil is so evil that we think that the good must be an accident. Beauty and brutality. But which of these is the deeper reality? Which of these reflects how things really are? And so we come to church, and we sing these songs, and we pray these prayers, and we listen to this sermon. And do these things testify to reality itself? Do they cut through the fog of our distraction with a moment of clarity? Or are these things the distractions, the noble lies that we tell ourselves to escape the brutality of how things really are? These are real questions with which I wrestle every single time I preach, because to preach is to say, in some sense, let me tell you how things really are. And who is sufficient for such a task? Let's hold on to these questions for a moment as we return to the text we've just read. Today, as you know, is the last Sunday of Epiphany, and next week will be the first Sunday of Lent. The church calendar, as you probably know, follows the story of Jesus in the Gospels. And no part of the story is more fitting, perhaps, for the transition between the brightness of Epiphany and the gathering darkness of Lent than this story of the Transfiguration. In all three of the Synoptic Gospels, there are three episodes that follow in immediate succession. Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah is followed by Jesus' announcement that he will suffer and die, which is immediately followed by the Transfiguration. So confession, followed by announcement, followed by Transfiguration, and then the rest of the Gospels are pointed towards Jerusalem, where Jesus will suffer and die. It's like the Gospel writers want us to know that inexplicably, this Messiah, the hope and expectation of Israel, is going to be killed. But before he walks that road to the cross, we are given a glimpse of glory, a glimpse, as it were, of how things really are. In the time we have together this morning, I'd like to look at Matthew's account of the Transfiguration a little bit more closely, because it is a passage that gives us a fresh vision of the past and the future. A passage that is trying to train our eyes and our ears to look and to listen. It invites us with the disciples to turn our eyes upon Jesus, to look him full in the face. And as it does, it hopes to make sense of the past, to give hope for the future, and to offer us courage for our present moment. So those are the three movements: past, future, present. Sorry, they don't start with the same letter. So we're going to look back, and then we're going to look forward, and finally we will, with the disciples, look up. So let's take the first movement, looking back. How does this story of the shining face of Jesus make sense of the past? Well, in this story, Jesus takes these three disciples up to the mountaintop, and it says he is transfigured before them. His face begins to shine like the sun. His clothes become white as light. And suddenly, Moses and Elijah are there having a conversation like you do. And the presence of these two heroes from the high past are the first clue that the story is trying to get us to go backwards, back to earlier parts of the story. The two great heroes of the Old Testament represent perhaps the law and the prophets that Jesus has come to fulfill. But as we look at this text, there are even more patterns that begin to emerge, and I'm going to belabor them just because I want you to see all of the layers that are happening in this text. First, there is the voice. "This is my son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased." We've heard these words before, have we not? In fact, in this gospel, in Matthew chapter 3, these are the words that are spoken over Jesus at his baptism as the Spirit descends as a dove. The Father's voice breaks through the heavens. "This is my son, whom I love, with whom I'm well pleased." Just before the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, now these words are spoken again, just after his announcement that he will die. So following his baptism and the Father's declaration of love, Jesus is led by the Spirit out into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And now, following the transfiguration and the Father's declaration of love, Jesus will be led by the Spirit to Jerusalem and to the cross. So in anticipation of the wilderness and anticipation of the cross, the voice of the Father breaks through with overflowing love. "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." As if the Father only has one thing to say about his Son. "That this is my Son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased." Now in our passage, the same words from Matthew 3 are repeated with one addition, a command. "Listen to him." Or as other versions have it, "Hear him." Now that command, the command to hear, takes us even further back to the book of Deuteronomy, the book that Jesus quoted 3 times when he was in the wilderness. The command to hear recalls the most well-known words in all of Israel's scriptures, the Shema. "Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel. The Lord your God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. Hear, O Israel." And the command to hear recalls another passage in Deuteronomy from chapter 18 when Moses promises that he will not be the last one, but there will be another prophet just like him. And him, Moses says, you shall hear. Indeed, the very shape of the story recalls another part further back in Exodus 24 when Moses takes 3 others with him and goes up the mountain to receive the law. As we read in chapter 24, 16 of Exodus, "The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai. The cloud covered it 6 days. And on the 7th day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud." You may remember that Moses' face shines from this encounter on the 7th day. And so now, in Matthew, he describes it as if a parallel event is occurring. After 6 days, on the 7th day, Jesus takes 3 to the mountaintop, just like Moses, and now from the face of Jesus, an even greater glory shines. It's like Moses is saying, this is the prophet Moses was talking about. This is a new Moses, a new liberator, a new lawgiver. Hear, O Israel, hear him. And then there are those first 3 words of the chapter. After 6 days, which take us back as far as we can go to the very first page of the story. And we remember how God created heaven and earth on 6 divine workdays, separated by evening and morning. And then, after 6 days, comes the 7th day, the day of divine rest, the day without evening or morning, the day upon which the sun never sets. The day of unending light. On that 7th day in Genesis, God rests in fulfillment of creation. On this seventh day in Matthew, Jesus shines like the sun in all of his glory. Now, I've belabored this point and taken you on this biblical theological journey to say that if our conception of Jesus is primarily tame as of a teacher or activist, this text challenges to look again, because all of the patterns from the Old Testament point to nothing less than divine glory. Can we believe this? The point of this patterning is that the full story of Israel, embodied in the law and the prophets, this full story is not being replaced by Jesus, but is being in some way transfigured. Jesus does not come to abolish Israel's hope, but to fill it full beyond their wildest imaginings, so that the one who raised the dry land up out of the sea, the one who raised Israel up out of Egypt, will be the one who raises Jesus from the dead. And so the transfiguration invites us to look back. And when it does, it reminds us that God's work did not begin with this scene, or with us, or with our part of the story. God has been shining and making and keeping promises since day one, since page one. And we are not the first to wonder. We are not the first to doubt. We are not the first to wrestle with faith. The name Israel, in fact, means to wrestle with God. But Matthew takes this story of wrestling and steps right into the middle of the struggle of Israel and makes an audacious claim that all of these promises and all of these hopes and all of these patterns find their fulfillment in the face of Jesus Christ. Here is the human face of God. And for one shining moment of clarity, at least for these disciples, the long history of Israel, with all of its defeats, makes sense. Have you ever had a moment like that? A moment of clarity, a moment when everything else seems to make sense. I'm not sure what your personal history is, but could you imagine what an encounter with Jesus might mean for the way you think about your past? So that when you look at the face of Jesus shining in his glory, that your past would begin to take on some sort of new meaning, if only for a moment, that everything has led up to this moment when the sometimes hidden face of God, which even Moses could not look on, is shown to us in the face of Jesus. Is it possible that your past and mine could be transfigured, given a new meaning? But there's still more for us here, because the vision of transfiguration does not just invite us to look backward, but also to look forward to the future. And this is the second movement, looking forward. What's going on with Jesus' face? Why does it shine like this? Well, Matthew, once again, is mining Old Testament expectation from Daniel, who wrote that after the resurrection, the righteous, the wise, will shine like the brightness of the heavens. That's a phrase that Jesus picks up and quotes in his own teaching. Just a few chapters earlier in Matthew chapter 13, he says, "The righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father." And here, we have the first fulfillment of Daniel and Jesus' words, not at the end of the age, but right now on this mountain. In other words, the transfiguration of Jesus anticipates the glory that is coming, first in his resurrection, and then in the resurrection of all of creation. Indeed, as we see in verse 9, the disciples are instructed not to speak of what they have seen until when? After the resurrection which will make the glory even more explicit. And so the transfiguration looks forward to the resurrection of Jesus and the restoration of creation. This is a foretaste. This is what's coming. The advanced radiance of the coming kingdom. See, the Christian hope is not meant to be wishful thinking, pie in the sky when you die. It is meant to be grounded on the most concrete reality imaginable, the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And that God will do one day for all of creation and for us what he has done in Jesus. This is a challenge to our minds, to our imaginations, is it not? Both to believe in his resurrection and to believe in our own. And yet the church has no other message than this, that God has raised Jesus from the dead, and everything can be different because of that. When creation is healed, the prophets tell us, when it is set free from its futility, we too will shine like stars. It's hard to imagine what that could mean, but however we imagine it, note that Jesus' transfiguration includes his clothing, that bit of human culture, taken up and transposed along with his body. Just as Jesus does not replace the past and does not replace Israel's story, so too Jesus does not replace our bodies and the human artifacts that we have with something more spiritual. All of these things, the things of earth, are taken up and given an even greater glory somehow. It reminds me of Marilynne Robinson's novel Gilead, in which an elderly character describes his anticipation of the new creation as a matter of thinking about the wonders of this world and then multiplying by two. I'd multiply by 10 or 12 if I had the energy, he said, but two is more than sufficient for my purposes. So he rocks in his porch chair, multiplying the feel of the wind by two, the smell of the grass by two. I like that. I like how concrete and human it is. It made me think, what would I multiply by two? Every bit of created goodness taken up and transposed, not replaced. But even as this vision that Jesus calls us to look forward to of creation healed is beautiful, it does not allow us to fast forward the journey to get there. In other words, it is not escapist. It is the opposite of escapist. Look at the story. Peter is so taken by the moment that he offers to build three shelters, three tabernacles, one for Moses and one for Elijah and one for Jesus. And as he's speaking, he's interrupted by the voice in the cloud, telling him to stop talking and start listening. Now, there's something right about Peter's desire to make a place, his attempt to honor this moment, to hold on to it, even to enshrine it in three tabernacles. But Matthew's point is that God is building a different sort of tabernacle for his people. Indeed, there will be no final temple, no true temple, without that journey to Jerusalem. The disciples cannot stay on the mountaintop. They must walk with Jesus to the cross. They must take up their own cross and follow him. They are not to speak about the transfiguration until after the resurrection, because they will not understand what happened on the mountain until they have passed through the valley of humiliation, until they have experienced life on the other side of death. See, to speak of the transfiguration before experiencing death and resurrection would lead you to a theology of glory, the expectation of health and wealth and prosperity. But to walk with Jesus to the cross, to carry the cross, will lead you to a theology of descent that recognizes the purpose of humiliation and pain and brokenness, just like Jesus. This is what Matthew wants to say to us, that the mountain may show us how things really are, who Jesus really is, that it gives a glimpse of glory so that we can live faithfully when our vision is less clear. But we cannot stay on the mountaintop, because it is in the valley, the place of testing, the place of cross carrying, the place where we wonder if this is how things really are, that we are truly transfigured and transformed. The light in the face of Jesus gives us hope, and hope will be needed. when the service ends, when the moment passes, when it is time to return to a world that remains as yet very much broken. So we look back and we look forward, but that's not where the text leads us ultimately. It leads us to this third movement where we look up. That's what it says of the disciples in verse 8, that they have been terrified and they've fallen on their faces, and Jesus comes to them and touches them, now with the glory of his face veiled once again. And they look up and they see him. How do we walk with the disciples and with Jesus back down the mountain? How do we return to ordinary life haunted by the awareness that there are more things in heaven and earth than we could dream? Once again, Robinson helps us look at the world through these new eyes. This is a quote that's almost on the last page of the book. It has seemed to me sometimes as though the Lord breathes on this poor gray ember of creation and it turns to radiance for a moment or a year or the span of a life. And then it sinks back into itself again, and to look at it, no one would know. But wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. You don't have to bring a thing to it except a little willingness to see. Only who could have the courage to see it? In a world of spin, cynicism comes naturally to us, does it not? But we need courage to look at the world through eyes of hope, to see the world sometimes shining like transfiguration. And where do we get this courage? Not just by looking back and not just by looking forward, but by looking up, looking away from ourselves, from the doubts and fears and shame that make us hang our heads, looking up at the face of Jesus. Where the glory may seem veiled to us, where his face may no longer shine with transfigured glory, but this does not change the truth about who he is. Because he will be in the valley what he was on the mountaintop. Indeed, he will show his glory most fully on the cross. Will we have the courage to see it? This ultimately is where the text has been driving our vision, looking at Jesus himself and listening to him, letting him tell us what is real, letting him teach us how things really are, letting him give us the eyes through which we look at the world. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. This is the first sermon I've ever preached on the Transfiguration. It's fresh. And I admit that trying to write a sermon on the Transfiguration feels a little bit like Peter trying to build this ramshackle booth of words to somehow house the glory in the face of Christ, but that's how every sermon feels to me. And I wonder how often God has thought of interrupting preachers as we multiply words with a voice that says, "Shh, this is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." I'm almost done now, but in one of George MacDonald's novels, he tells the story of Thomas Wingfold, a minister who realizes that he really does not believe in God. And the novel takes us through the account of Wingfold's awakening, first to his doubt, and then to his faith. And as he is in process, he preaches a sermon to a congregation that is surprised to hear a preacher speak so openly. And this is what he says. "Hear me, my friends. I dare not say that I know there is a Father. I dare not even say I think. I can only say with my whole heart, I hope we have indeed a Father in heaven. But this man, Jesus, says he knows. Am I to say he does not know? If he tells me he knows, I am silent and I listen." Who am I to say what any of this means? How things really are? And yet here is the heart of all my hopes, that Jesus says he knows. What is real? What is true? What is deeper? Well, Jesus says he knows. And so faith is not my triumphant assertion that I know how things really are. No, it is the trust that he knows. It is not something I hold. It holds me. And so all I can really do is read the text again and again and repeat the words that the Father speaks about the Son. This is the Son whom the Father loves. Listen to him. And perhaps as we listen, we would hear God say, "Are you afraid? Are you anxious of what the future may bring? Are you uncertain if you will have what it takes for the challenges that lie ahead? Are you caught between a past that you cannot change and a future you cannot control? This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." Because all that the church really has to offer is its testimony, its story of the glimpse we've had of how things really are. All that the church can really do is keep creating space for listening and speaking, a place to keep telling our story, a place to keep breaking bread and pouring the wine that testifies to welcome and embrace, testifying to our hope. That in Jesus we have seen a glimpse of the fulfillment of Israel's ancient story and a glimpse of the new world that is coming. That we have caught just a glimpse of who he is. And that light sometimes seems to fade. Most days everything looks ordinary. Everything feels empty. We walk in the darkness toward the cross again. But the light shines through the cracks. And that light, in the face of Jesus Christ, is everything. And it's enough. Will you pray with me? God, you know that we are part of this people who wrestle with you, who are trying to surrender control in a world that feels out of control. And so, God, will you give us by your Spirit a moment of clarity in which we hear the voice that speaks to us, directing us to see the Son whom you love, with whom you are well pleased, and to listen to him. In him is the heart of all of our hopes. May we entrust ourselves to Jesus more fully today. May you give us courage to see the world in the light of transfigured glory. And we pray this in his name. Amen.